When the art day gets rough, you just gotta keep on punching. And here's your Thunder Punch Daily with Jersey Drozd.
Hey, it's me, Jersey, and it's time for your Thunder Punch Daily, the show I record not so daily, sharing a few thoughts from the mind of a cartoonist. I've been asked in the past to do some reviews of comics that I've been reading. For those who are new to the comics medium, who don't necessarily play in the pool of the direct market or even pay terribly close attention to what's been getting the buzz in the comic circles. And let's face it, it's tough staying on top of all this stuff that's going on. I mean, I've said elsewhere many times that comics is undergoing one of the greatest flourishings it's ever experienced in the medium's history in the last decade or so, which is super exciting. But it also means that there's an impossible amount of stuff to stay on top of. I mean, being married to a librarian, I see what she's going through in terms of trying to stay on top of everything. And she's got an advantage being in a place where new comics are coming in all the time. But in terms of selecting, in terms of investing time in reading something, it's a pretty big job to try to stay on top of all this stuff. And so I can see in that respect what the value would be of hearing the voice of somebody who you maybe have invested a little bit of trust in, lending itself to pointing you at some books that may be worth your time. So that said, I feel an obligation to not just talk about a comic that is worth reading just for pure entertainment, but also point out the artistic merits of this book as I see them, at any rate. You know, the disclaimer that I haven't used in a long time, but is worth repeating, is that these are just my opinions. This is just my viewpoint on comics. And, you know, we should always remember that when you're listening to something that I have to say about it. So I finished reading Peter Bagg's Other Lives. Now, Peter Bagg, if you haven't heard of him, he is a well-respected cartoonist who works in kind of a sort of a modern interpretation of 1960s underground comics. His influences are probably, or at least what I interpret them to be, like Robert Crumb. I forget the name of the artist who did the Fabulous Furry Freak Brothers. It shares a lot of DNA with that kind of, what do I want to say? I don't want to say dirty, but kind of a brutally honest art style, kind of informed in 60s underground is also like it's sort of like this I should have prepared the words before I started this one. It's when you look at it, it's not about representational beauty. It's taking a lot of, in my interpretation, a lot of 1930s kind of cartooning styles like E.C. Segar, like, you know, old 40s Disney Steamboat Willie kind of cartoons, and mixing them with inking styles and with the sort of abstracted styles that can really point at just how ugly people are and can be sometimes. But at the same time, you know, this is art, and sometimes pointing at the ugliness also reveals like a deeper beauty in life, right? So I don't want to say that Peter Bagg stuff is ugly, but he focuses sometimes on ugliness, and his characters often are not idealized people, but people as they are. And when we look at people as they are, they can be sometimes quite ugly. So he did this graphic novel called, here's why I got to take a step back. The cover of the graphic novel gave me a chuckle because there's a pull quote by Dan Clowes, and he describes the book as a compelling and very funny examination of the creepy duality of modern existence by a comic book, and then in parentheses, then he says, sorry, graphic novel, master, at the height of his powers. That had to make me smile, you know, because, yeah, after all, why can't we just call them comic books? But at the same time, we have to acknowledge that for the general public, we need to hear that word graphic novel, at least in the United States, in order to take it seriously, because it is a serious book. It's really interesting. It is funny, but the humor is pretty subdued in service of this kind of hard examination of other lives, to go by the cover, the duality that we can live in the analog world, thinking we're one thing when we're really another, And then also examining that again through the lens of Second Life. If anybody remembers that, that Second Life, that virtual world you could exist in and create an avatar for yourself and live out a fantasy life. And he, what's great about this book, I'll just start with talking about the tone just for a second, is he does it in, I think, a very honest and, for the most part, objective way. This isn't an indictment of Second Life. He uses Second Life to sort of reflect his overall themes about how this is something we've been doing all along. Second Life is not a new thing in the sense of providing us with the opportunity to lie to ourselves about who we are or to blur the distinction between fantasy and reality. He just uses that as a lens to look at it. But while meanwhile, there are other characters who don't participate in the Second Life world in this story who are clearly misunderstanding who they are and are lying to themselves in very substantial ways. And then there are other characters who have a very healthy interpretation of the difference between fantasy and reality. People who participate in the Second Life world and understand that there is a line between that world and our world, and we are who we are. But this is a fun place to play. And then I will say, without spoiling anything, it ends with sort of reflection on a very positive spin to the whole idea of what, how can a fantasy world be used to enhance our lives without risking that kind of blurring of distinction. So what's the plot? The story is essentially, or for the most part, about a guy named Vlad. Well, he goes by the name Vader. Let's see if I can pronounce his last name. Well, he's Russian. It's like Rostock or something like that. But he goes by another name, which is part of this whole theme. And he is a reporter who is investigating, or rather doing an article on a guy who claims to work with the CIA to hunt down and capture terrorists. And when he meets this guy to do the story on him, this guy, all signs point to this guy is not telling the truth because he lives with his mother, he lives in the garage, and he wears superhero t-shirts all the time. He looks like the stereotypical comic book guy. And what's more is Vlad, or Vader as he goes by, he finds there's something familiar about this guy that he's talking to. Vlad is also engaged to be married to his girlfriend Ivy, who is a Chinese woman who is a little bit obsessed with this idea of getting married. She's crazy about Vlad, but she really, really is insisting on getting married and getting a little caught up in this whole idea of this big wedding. And then enter Vlad's old friend Woodrow. Now, Woodrow comes into the story to shed some light on this CIA agent that Vlad is talking to, giving him some more information that helps him uncover some more of these layers of lies surrounding. I think he goes by the name Otis, this CIA agent, but it's revealed that his real name is Javier, which reveals a whole nother layer of backstory. But Woodrow invites Ivy to start playing around in Second Life, or I think they call it like Second World, I think is the name he uses for that. And it becomes very clear very quickly that Woodrow has a really hard time distinguishing between what's happening in Second Life and what's real. And he has his own layers of lies that he's been throwing on top of himself in order to justify his existence, in order to keep appearances, and they get progressively darker and stranger. I should have said this at the top, and I'll say this now. Before you go and read it, I do want to say that if this was a movie, it would be definitely rated R for mature language, adult situations, and some violence. It's a Peter Bagg story, after all, and he is very brutally honest with his stories, and he doesn't sugarcoat anything. But at the same time, I'm going off on a tangent here talking about the style, because I do want to talk about it, the art style and what it does that's really unique. At the same time, because he comes from that 60s underground kind of background, because the style is informed by that, which itself is informed by like 1930s kind of cartooning, it delivers kind of a brutal ugliness about people, but at the same time, it kind of detaches you from it because it's so abstracted. It's so cartoony that some of the violence becomes horrifically comical in a way. I don't want to say comical like as in you laugh, but you're detached from it. It's horrible. It's scary, but it doesn't feel like you're watching a real a movie where you're watching somebody's head get exploded in front of you or anything like that. So just be warned about that. It is a comic for adults. I would certainly not recommend this to a 12-year-old. But getting back to the plot, things all come to a head as these four characters kind of follow their arcs. And again, I don't want to spoil anything for those who want to, you know, actually read the book. But the really neat thing is how Bag managed to create a single theme that is explored through four different characters in their own lives. All of the themes reflect the overall theme, but everybody's theme has its own inflection because of the biographies of each of the individual characters. So Vlad, who doesn't use Second Life, goes through the exact same discovery of, I thought I was this, but I'm really that in the story. He thinks he's one thing, but he's really another. And he has constructed an entire fantasy around himself through some misunderstandings about his own past. Whereas characters like Woodrow, he does have some discoveries, but it's more about watching him descend into further and further into this lack of distinction between what's real and what's not, which drives him to do some very frightening things. Same with Otis or Javier, who goes through the exact same thing. He starts out fully embroiled in that merging of fantasy and reality, and in the final moments of the story, in the climax of the story, he finally sort of starts to break out, but it's not clear if he's fully broken out of that kind of quagmire of blurring fantasy and reality. Meanwhile, Ivy is an interesting character because she keeps that distinction clear, and it's not through being some kind of a super person, some kind of brilliant mind. It's just that she's healthy. So it's three very mentally kind of unbroken men and one woman who has who seems silly at the outset. I mean, being a bridezilla and all, right? Like getting all crazy about preparing for a wedding. But really, she is emotionally the strongest character in the story. But I was really impressed with how well the themes played out all through all the characters. And this comes back to this whole idea of tight storytelling, where nothing is in there just for the sake of just for pure fun or pleasure. It's all there. It's all fun, but it's all there to reflect the overall vision of the story, which is something we talked about a lot in Art and Story. Let's talk about what the art and what he does with it. Okay, so I want to get to why this is, like, from a cartoonist artist standpoint, why this book has merit to me. It surprises me that in this day and age, where the quote-unquote mainstream comics, we gotta find a better word for them, guys. The traditional superhero comics, which are trying so hard to feel more like an HBO TV series or a movie with this kind of sparse staccato rhythm dialogue, only three panels to a page, one word balloon per panel. Nothing wrong with that style, but it's such a trend right now that it makes me miss the days when thought balloons were used, where you had this density of dialogue rhythms where you could have 4 to 5 word balloons in a panel. Because after all, comics can clarify a story to the point where it feels condensed, but there's really 12 layers of stuff happening in one static image. This is why, one of the main reasons I get so, so excited about comics as a medium, because it can do things that other mediums can't, after all. And Bag's story, Other Lives, is a wonderful example of this. He'll have 4 to 5 word balloons per panel, and there's so much happening in this one static image. There's so many visual cues here to, like, the steam coming off of somebody's head because they're frustrated, the twitching of somebody's foot as they're sitting in a chair, so that it's delivering a ton of information with one static image. So this whole, like, going back 8 years, talking about this decompression that was happening in comic storytelling, at least in the direct market superhero comics publishing, where they were trying to decompress to make it feel more like cinema. It's incredibly refreshing to go back and look at somebody who is informed by older comic styles, classic comic styles. And hey, let's face it, not just American comic styles, but like the Belgian comics styles of actually using the symbol system of comics effectively. Now, if somebody's reading this for the first time and they don't read comics very regularly, it may come off as being a little too dense and a little too garish in the symbol usage, with the sweat beads flying off the heads, the motion lines showing somebody nervously twitching. Again, like the shocked lines when somebody turns their head and says, "What?" And then you have like the little darts of black coming out of their forehead to show that they're shocked about something. And also thought balloons. But at the same time, just because a non-traditional comics reader might find that unusual, doesn't that mean that means that comics is doing what comics does best? I come back to this idea of, like, you know, why would cartoonists try to mimic other media? Yes, borrow from other media, but don't try to mimic other media in order to try to win new readers. Let's celebrate what comics can do. And so it was incredibly refreshing to read this story, as dark as it was, to see that here's a guy who actually loves comics for comics' sake, and he uses all of its affordances. Now, is he doing anything crazy with layout? Not really. He's not doing any kind of experimental stuff, but he has great storytelling beats. He has great visual rhythms to it. He uses blacks really effectively. He has really, really great black placements. I can look at any one of his pages and do the squint test on it and get a real sense of there's at least a visual composition to the page, even if the panels aren't arranged in kind of any kind of crazy ways. It is just a story about four people going through a life. There's no, you know, big action sequences. There's no car chases or explosions, any of the stuff I like to put in my stories. The comedy is relatively subdued, but at the same time, you know, I don't want anybody to think that there's nothing, you know, what am I trying to say? Well, here's what I'm trying to say. Is because of that, I think it would actually work against his story to use a lot of cockeyed and sophisticated panel layouts. I think this kind of story demands more of a grid style storytelling. Let the art inside the panels actually do the sophisticated, complicated stuff. But still, his paneling is terrific. It's absolutely terrific. So, oh, and there's another thing that I think is really neat from an experimental storyteller standpoint. There's a lot of sequences that take place within Second Life. So he switches to a different kind of storytelling in those sequences, where we're watching the Second Life world happening, and underneath each panel is the text chat that's happening while those moments are happening. So it's not characters interacting with word balloons, it's characters moving around and doing things, but then underneath it'll have, you know, this is what Ivy's saying, this is what Woodrow's saying, and it'll even have a sound effect in the chat, you know. So it's pretty cool at trying to really drive home this idea that, okay, you're watching a completely different kind of narrative happening here. It also helps detach that whole Second Life thing from the real world in a very nice visual way, and plus it just makes sense. So there's my review. If I'm trying to think of what I could compare it to in terms of television, it's a pretty short story by comparison. It's well, it's like about 136 pages. And so it's an afternoon read, but it's a dense read. So, I mean, I was also really pleasantly surprised with how 130-something pages could actually eat up an entire afternoon for me, rather than 130 pages of traditional American comics. Would be maybe 20 minutes, half hour reading. So, but even if it doesn't sound like it's your cup of tea in terms of the content of the story, I do think from a deconstructionist standpoint, it's really good reading to look at how well he filtered the themes through the story, how good his black placements are, how much you can cram in a panel without it feeling crammed, how a panel as a unit of time represents a much larger unit of time. And it's, like I said, it's refreshing to see somebody actually doing that. So, and I think that's why the story takes so long to read, comparatively speaking, because it may be 136 pages, but it reads like a 400-page book. So, okay, that's what I got for today. Link in the show notes, and I'll even include an Amazon affiliate link, so if you guys buy it, it'll give a little kickback to me. But I also recommend that you just go and check it out at your local library if you can get it there. I got mine from the Ann Arbor District Library, so it's possible. It's published through Vertigo, so, I mean, it got some pretty wide distribution, so you might want to check your local library first. Anyway, who am I? I'm Jersey Droz, jdroz.com, Jersey on the Twitters. Thank you very much for supporting us in this project. We couldn't do it without you. If you enjoyed this review, if this was useful to you, let me know, and I'll be glad to do more, because I am reading a lot of comics lately, and I'm trying to keep my eye out for things that are worthy of picking apart and sharing with you guys. And if I don't hear from anybody, then maybe I'll put it on the back burner for a while and see if there's some other place where I could put this kind of content. Because the last thing I want to do is bore you guys. So I'll be back soon with another Thunder Punch Daily. And until then, remember, everybody.
In today's story, the Aquaticans were afraid to trust us because we looked different from them. Merman talked them into thinking we were their enemies, and it almost caused great harm. You should never judge a person by the way he looks, but rather by the way he behaves.
Because it's what's inside a person that really counts, right?
Orko, you're absolutely right.
I always am.